Nuclear responsibility. That's what the American states are tasked with. Responsibility for safety, for cleanups, for state laws and regulations designed to not get we the people into a nuclear mess in the first place. So how are they doing? I recently talked with two activists focused on two different issues in two different states. I initially thought they were separate stories, but found out they were opposite poles of the exact same issues. Both cited the importance of state laws and responsibilities, but reported far different outcomes. When one spoke of recent successful actions in Hawaii, she told us,
as the federal government weakens environmental protection and reviews and weakens the National Regulatory Commission, the NRC, state laws are going to matter the most. And that means that's true for nuclear power, and that's true for like data centers, you know, like states stepping up and protecting themselves and their constituents matter. So we need to empower states to protect themselves against the federal government.
Then another citizen activist told me about a devastating loss in state regulation enforcement in Southern California. She said,
DTSC, that agency, that government agency, actually had set aside $2 million to use for this lawsuit. $2 million, might I add, of taxpayer dollars for our specific lawsuit. They specified that. It just seems outrageous to me that they could use my own taxpayer dollars to stop me from trying to fight for a cleanup that they should have done and should have been protecting our kids.
Well, when Linda Williams in Hawaii and Melissa Bumstead in Southern California report on actions or inactions regarding nuclear issues in their respective states, it's clear that as federal environmental laws keep getting weakened, the states are now the major players in preventing or enabling our collective slip and slide further into that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, two reports on activist actions dealing with state government agencies here in the U.S. In Hawaii, we hear from Linda Williams, a physicist and lifelong activist who has been involved with the state's deliberations on whether it needs to pursue nuclear energy or not. Here's a hint. It's good news. Then we talk with Melissa Bumstead of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab here in Southern California about a recent court ruling regarding the radioactive and toxic cleanup of that Superfund site that Boeing is supposed to do. Here's a hint. It is not good news. We will also have other nuclear news from around the world. Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness. Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story. And more honest nuclear information than will ever be released by a presidential executive order. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, January 13, 2026, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out with the return of Linda Pence Gunter, who asks the question, are Trump's yes men poised to license a dangerous new reactor? Here she is with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
As we all know, the Donald Trump regime loves a yes man. after the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission was ordered late last year to effectively rubber stamp reactor license approvals in order to fulfill the White House's mad plans of bringing new reactors online at lightning speed, you could not find a more obsequious yes man than NRC chair, Republican appointee David Wright. Last week, the White House announced it was demoting Wright from his position as chair and replacing him with one of Trump's two recent Republican commission appointees, Ho Nee. Wright had only been chair since January 2025, replacing Democrat Christopher Hansen, who was fired from that position and the commission itself in an unorthodox and likely illegal move by Trump at the start of his second term. This set up a 3-2 Republican majority on the commission instead of the other way around that Trump should not have had. In a hearing last September before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, Wright had wriggled around before questioning from Democrats, insisting his integrity was watertight and that the NRC was in safe hands. He would, he insisted, never make the wrong decision on safety. Do you acknowledge that if you find that a reactor design is unsafe and vote that way, that you may be fired by the administration? California Democrat Adam Schiff had asked. It doesn't matter. I'm going to make the right decision and I'll stand by that decision, Wright insisted. Perhaps Wright was a little too obviously obsequious, even for the Trump administration, who don't exactly hide their hubris, lies, bias, and corruption under a bushel. We will likely never know. What we will soon know is whether the commissioners will indeed grant a license to a patently dangerous reactor. We are using the term dangerous here under their own definition. All of us already know that every nuclear reactor design is inherently dangerous, and the so-called new ones haven't changed that reality one iota. That's because on December 1 last year, the NRC announced that its staff had completed their final safety evaluation for the Bill Gates company TerraPower's small modular reactor design. In keeping with the make-haste mandate from the White House, the NRC staff had concluded that, quote, there are no safety aspects that would preclude issuing the construction permit. This is the 345-megawatt sodium-cooled fast reactor called the Natrium and designated for a site in Kemmerer, Wyoming. The NRC staff even bragged about how they, quote, finished our technical work on the Kemmerer review a month ahead of our already accelerated schedule as we aim to make licensing decisions for new advanced reactors in no more than 18 months, said Jeremy Groom, acting director of the NRC's Office of Nuclear Reactor Regulation. That means that the five commissioners will now vote any day on the final environmental impact statement their staff have approved for the reactor. But not so fast. I'd say this was a joke, but it's no laughing matter, wrote Dr. Ed Lyman, a physicist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who is deeply familiar with the technology being promoted by TerraPower and other experimental reactor startups. The only way they could pull this off is by sweeping difficult safety issues under the rug or putting them off until the operating license phase. This is a dangerous reactor, Lyman said in a December 2 statement. We now wait to see whether the commissioners will duly do the sweeping. Unfortunately, they will get plenty of help from Congress. Nuclear power is not a partisan issue, with Democrats cheerleading the technology just as hard from their side of the aisle. Some have expressed concerns about safety issues, most recently New Jersey Democrat Frank Pallone, during a hearing of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce last Wednesday. I've been supportive of nuclear, Pallone said. If anything happens that gives the impression or actually makes it so that people's lives are at risk, he added, that's going to be the end of it. Well, Frank, I have news for you. People's lives are at risk already and every day, as long as nuclear power plants are operating. Never mind the reckless and untested new designs that also lend themselves to nuclear weapons production. The title of last week's House hearing alone was the giveaway, buying not only into the Trump agenda, but the rhetoric as well. This was a hearing on, quote, American energy dominance, dawn of the new nuclear era. The witnesses came from the Nuclear Energy Institute, the nuclear industry's paid propaganda arm, and from Southern Company, the Nuclear Innovation Alliance, and the Idaho National Laboratory. Do you think any of them were going to do anything other than assure the representatives that nuclear power was perfectly safe? Did they invite Ed Lyman or M.V. Ramana or Arjun Makhijani, physicists who actually understand how precisely dangerous these new reactor schemes are? Did they invite Amory Lovins to blow the lid off the extreme costs or Mark Jacobson to educate them on how they could achieve their same goals with renewables instead? And did they invite anyone from the targeted communities to see if they actually wanted these things in their neighborhoods or had even been consulted? Nope, 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 and nope. At least 60% of Americans now say they want more nuclear power, according to a recent Pew Research Center poll. Of course they do, because they, like members of Congress, are only listening to the nuclear industry party line, blasted across our airwaves and in every newspaper as if it's gospel. Lyman calls the Kemmerer project Cowboy Chernobyl. It's time we drove them off into the sunset, not in glory, but in disgrace. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
In other U.S. news, Google has unveiled a plan to restart a nuclear facility in Iowa to power the company's artificial intelligence infrastructure. The Duane Arnold Energy Center, which shuttered in 2020, would return to service in 2029, quote, to help power Google's growing cloud and AI infrastructure in Iowa. Google signed off on a 25-year agreement to purchase power from the facility once it is restarted. The plant will be 100% owned by NextEra Energy. AI has emerged as a major usurper of energy and water and has begun to meet with resistance. Despite Google's powerful intentions, this is not a done deal. Here's a question. Is there another option to get the nuclear waste out of San Onofre? Some 3.55 million pounds of nuclear waste is beached at this now-shuttered nuclear plant on the shores of the Pacific Ocean. The spent fuel is held in more than 120 stainless steel canisters, only 5/8 of an inch thick, with each canister containing the equivalent of a Chernobyl's worth of radiation. The federal government has yet to find a permanent repository to send this waste, and it's not just an issue for San Onofre, but for all spent fuel that has stacked up over the years at commercial nuclear power plants across the country. We'll have a link to this article on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 759. One of the things we strive to do here at Nuclear Hot Seat is keep you up to date on stories we've been covering for a while, because things change. One of those stories has been the Santa Susana Field Lab here in Southern California, only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles and, when the crow flies in a slightly different arc, only 30 miles from where I live. It's a Boeing site contaminated not only with decades of rocket fuel testing toxins, but radioactivity emitted from unshielded reactors, accidents, radiation leaks, spills, and shallow dumps of radioactive material to try to cover up the mess. This Superfund site is considered one of the most contaminated in the country, and the group Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab have been fighting for a cleanup for years. Here with a brief rundown on the history and the recent shocking development in the fight to get a full cleanup of the site is Melissa Bumstead. She is founder and co-director, Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. I spoke with Melissa Bumstead on January 12, 2026. Melissa Bumstead, it's always great to have you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Unfortunately, it's not good news this time. You have been involved with the Santa Susana Field Lab here in Southern California. Give people a little bit of background as to what it is and what the issues are there.
I live only a few miles from the Santa Susana Field Lab, one of California's most toxic and radioactive Superfund sites. It was used in the late 40s for rocket engine testing during the Cold War and America's Race to Space program. Not long after that, they started nuclear experimentation. They had 10 reactors on site. Many of those had issues, meltdowns, leaks, fires, spills, and has left the soil and the groundwater extensively contaminated today. It's primarily owned by the Boeing Company, and the Department of Energy and NASA are also responsible for the site's cleanup.
There has been an ongoing battle by a group you certainly were one of the founders of, called Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. What have you been doing? And give us a brief sense of what the back and forth has been for years now.
Well, I've been involved in this for almost 10 years, and several other environmental groups have been involved even longer, trying to get the site cleaned up. We started because my daughter is one of over 100 children in our community with extremely rare pediatric cancer. And we believe the site has been causing it. So we've come together to fight for the complete cleanup, believing it's the only way to protect our environment, our water, the wildlife, and especially our children who are very vulnerable to exposure. The site will cost hundreds of millions of dollars to clean up. We know that. And it was supposed to be cleaned up by 2017, a complete cleanup, removing all man-made contamination. And that hasn't happened.
Where was the promise made, or how was that timeline and that deadline set?
So back in 2007, Boeing, NASA, and the Department of Energy signed agreements with Cal EPA and one of its agencies called the Department of Toxic Substances Control, which is a regulating agency in California. Then in 2010, even more comprehensive cleanup standards were agreed to by NASA and Department of Energy. Boeing refused to sign it. So right from there, only 3 years later, we're seeing some true opposition from the Boeing company for the cost of what this cleanup would be. Because the second agreement, you know, you get what you pay for. A more comprehensive cleanup that was going to ensure that contamination wasn't left behind would cost more. Boeing refused to sign it. And that's a pattern we've been seeing ever since. Although we have these legal agreements with NASA and Department of Energy in 2010, pretty much whatever Boeing does, NASA and Department of Energy say, well, we want to do that too. So Boeing has really become the tail that wags the dog. So fast forward to 2022, and the Boeing company and Cal EPA have signed an agreement, a settlement agreement, that could allow Boeing to leave up to 95% of their contamination on site permanently. And this was done behind closed doors. The public was not allowed to be involved. We were not allowed to be part of that discussion. We were not allowed to review the results of it. It was immediately made effective, and it superseded the 2007 agreement. To me, that's criminal. And I guess really it was, because it broke California environmental laws called CEQA. And our group, Parents Against Santa Susana Field Lab, along with Physicians for Social Responsibility Los Angeles, and Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, called PEER, all three of us sued. We sued DTSE and Boeing for this agreement that broke California law.
There has recently been a development. What was the lead up to it, and what happened?
In 2022, we hired a lawyer who is an expert in CEQA law cases. And we spoke with several other environmental lawyers. They all said this was going to be an open and shut case, that it was a clear violation of CEQA. And it was so clear that our lawyer even filed it to expedite the case. From the second we entered court, there was huge opposition from the Department of Toxic Substances Control and Boeing. In fact, we learned later that DTSE, that agency, that government agency, actually had set aside $2 million to use for this lawsuit. $2 million, might I add, of taxpayer dollars for our specific lawsuit. They specified that. It just seems outrageous to me that they could use my own taxpayer dollars to stop me from trying to fight for a cleanup that they should have done and should have been protecting our kids. So there was a lot of opposition. We saw all kinds of tricks and ploys and legal maneuvering that delayed the decision for 2 years. We had to fight every step of the way for every period that was put on the paper. We had to fight to justify it. And recently, we got the final verdict. The verdict came from the Ventura County Superior Court, and they sided with the Department of Toxic Substances Control and Boeing. We were all shocked. And not only did this seem open and shut, our lawyer did an excellent job. The case was made very clear. We had all the evidence to show why this broke environmental law, and it just didn't happen. I think my personal opinion is that the judge just felt more comfortable trusting a government agency. I mean, really, that is how it should work. Government agencies aren't meant to be influenced by major corporations. But that's not the case. That's not the case. And we know that not only from the Santa Susana Field Lab, but other environmental justice groups across California have all said that the DTSC always favors polluters, favors builders, favors politics, and they don't fight for the people. Even when they have evidence that shows that it will harm people, they're known for that. They have a reputation for that in California.
So where do you go now? Is there a future action you can take? Can you go up to a higher court? Is there a way to delay the delaying?
So we're looking at short-term and long-term plans. Our short-term plan is considering an appeal. So we're talking to experts, seeing, you know, what would that really accomplish? But obviously we have to consider the cost. And that just, it just makes me so mad that this huge major corporation that has all this money, and the Department of Toxic Substances Control took $2 million of taxpayer dollars. And we have to pay for this lawsuit ourselves. This is coming from our incredibly small environmental group with some financial support from the other two NGOs. But really, it just continues to feel like David versus Goliath moment. And not only do they have the power, but they have all the money. And our community has already suffered so much. So that's our short-term approach, seeing what other legal options we have available. There were resolutions passed by the City of Los Angeles, the City of Simi Valley, Ventura County, and Los Angeles County. They passed motions several years ago to sue if the cleanup was not done to a background or to remove all man-made contamination level. They have not enforced that. They have not begun that lawsuit. That might be another option to see if they will go after Boeing. But right now, the political environment just unmotivated, pretty much because the world is a dumpster fire right now. I get that. But this is so critical. This is our moment of need. My long-term plan is to go to the gym more often because, you know, at some point we, and I'm joking here, but at some point we might end up naked, handcuffed to all the machinery at the gate of the SSFL. I need to have a bikini-ready body for that if I'm going to show up international news, one of 100 moms tied up naked to stop the protest, you know? Like, what will it take? I don't know. Is that the furthest extent of what it will take to get someone to take this seriously? I mean, we laugh because we have to. The emotional trauma of this just gets to be really overwhelming sometimes. You know, I took a whole morning off to cry when we found out we lost the lawsuit, because we really had hoped and believed that justice would prevail and that would give us a huge tool. So when we're done crying, my co-director Jenny and I, we try to do something to make us laugh, because it's the only way to really keep this fight going. It's just too important, obviously, to quit. We can't afford to quit. You know, the Santa Susana Field Lab it's toxic. It has long-lasting chemicals. It has toxic metals. They did a lot of metal experimentation up there. And then we have the radionuclides. The Boeing company's property is primarily chemical contamination. And they have said that they will do a background cleanup to remove all man-made radionuclides. However, you know, we're seeing all kinds of strategies to try to undo that in a very deceptive manner. So even though what we're looking at right now is primarily chemical contamination, like I said, this is the tail that wags the dog. And Department of Energy, which is Area 4, that's incredibly radioactive area where they did all this, you know, for years research, they've already said that if Boeing gets away with this lesser cleanup, they intend to follow suit. So that's why Boeing's involvement right now is so critically important to get them back on track for the health of the community, obviously, but also for the example that is going to be followed by the other responsible parties.
What, if anything, can listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat do to support you?
Oh, thank you. We would love the support of your listeners. There's some easy actions, like our change.org/Santa Susana. That petition can be signed from anyone all across the world. That's really available. For anyone living in California, you can write your elected official and tell them that you want them to get involved with a full cleanup and that it's time to make these responsible parties protect the community, protect the environment. We always take donations. We'd be happy to put that towards any lawsuits that we might need to move forward. And just in general, to get people talking about it. That is one of our biggest problems, is Los Angeles is so big. And because we don't have advertising funding or it's very hard to get the word out. People, you know, we have all of our tree-hugging granola friends in Santa Monica, probably less than 30 miles away, and they don't even know that they're living next to a radioactive site. Pretty much we're at the point where if anyone can do anything, that would help us.
We'll put this up. We will have the links on the website under this episode. And what can I say? I wish you all well. Santa Susana Field Lab is only 30 miles from where I live. So I'm not like right butt up against it like you are, but I ain't that far away. The wind blows, the dust kicks up. I know what's there and I don't like it. So Melissa, for you and the other individuals, parents or friends or colleagues or whoever who is fighting against this, I want to thank you for your work. And I want to thank you in particular for making the time to be my guest this day on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Melissa Bumstead, founder and co-director, Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. We'll have a link up to her group and their change.org petition on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 759. Over to Japan, where former Japanese Prime Minister Shigeru Ishiba has again criticized recent remarks by a senior government official suggesting that Japan should possess nuclear weapons. Ishiba said that as the only country in the world to have suffered atomic bombings, Japan should take a clear stance on preventing nuclear proliferation and should not make statements that undermine that position. On December 18, an anonymous senior official in charge of security at the Prime Minister's office told reporters that Japan should possess nuclear weapons. After the remarks were made public, they sparked widespread criticism and controversy within Japan. Addressing the issue earlier, Ishiba said that if Japan were to acquire nuclear weapons, it would be forced to withdraw from the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, as well as the International Atomic Energy Agency. He stressed that such a move would render Japan's nuclear energy policy, which underpins the country's energy system, untenable, adding that, quote, "This would by no means be beneficial for Japan." As to nuclear power, as she settles into the nation's top office, Japan's Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi's energy policy is focusing on conventional nuclear power and the pursuit of futuristic technologies like nuclear fusion. That's what's being prioritized, while renewable energy, especially megasolar, is getting less attention. Over her short 2 months in office, Takaichi has emphasized the restart of aging nuclear reactors and developing futuristic, but not yet commercially viable, technologies like nuclear fusion. She has also given considerably less attention to renewables, with the exception of geothermal, all with the goal of making Japan 100% energy self-sufficient. In response to her policies, a group of Japanese protesters gathered in front of the Prime Minister's official residence in Tokyo on December 28 to show opposition to the government's decision to restart the world's largest nuclear power plant, Kashiwazaki Kariwa, in Niigata Prefecture. Their opposition is based on the state of the aging facilities, inadequate oversight, and disregard for historical disasters. Kashiwazaki Kariwa was among the 54 reactors shut down in Japan following the March 2011 core meltdowns at TEPCO's tsunami-stricken Fukushima Daiichi plant. This would mark the first time for TEPCO to restart a nuclear power plant since the Fukushima disaster. Historically, Kashiwazaki Kariwa previously experienced fires during earthquakes, and there are also reports of a fault line in the area. And it isn't Japan, but Indonesia, which is the focus of this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
Food, glorious food. Well, not necessarily. There has been yet another recall of radioactively contaminated seafood, this time frozen shrimp, as announced by the Food and Drug Administration. The FDA initiated its first recall on August 19, announcing that certain frozen raw shrimp products processed by Indonesian company BMS Foods had tested positive for radioactive cesium-137, not a food additive you want. A handful of manufacturers sold these products under different brand names to retailers nationwide. Then the FDA published an expanded recall notice on its website on December 19, one of now 12 notices that have been issued in the growing recall. This time, Washington-based company Direct Source said it's recalling approximately 83,800 bags of the product, which had been imported from Indonesia and sold under the Market 32 and Waterfront Bistro brands. The frozen shrimp was sold at Price Chopper stores in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York, Pennsylvania, and Vermont, and Jewel, Osco, Albertsons, Safeway, Lucky, and supermarket stores in Colorado, Iowa, Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Montana, North Dakota, Nevada, Oregon, Utah, and Wyoming. This joins the October 14 recall of cloves grown at a clove farm on Sumatra Island, Sumatra being part of Indonesia. The FDA recently said it had detected the presence of cesium-137 in a sample of cloves from PT Natural Java Spice during the screening. So what gives, Indonesia? Is it the product, the processing, the packaging? Or, as has been suggested, radioactive contamination of the shipping containers, which has been detected? No way to know, but best to not take chances. So if you have that terrific recipe for sambal goreng udang, shrimp seasoned with spices including cloves, don't do it. Contact your local grocery chain management about possible cesium-137 contamination that they need to check on in any products shipped from or through Indonesia. And as those suspected radioactive shipping containers circulate around the international food and shipping lanes, maybe just buy your food at the local farmer's market. Because those companies that import food from or through Indonesia have no real control over radiation exposure or the quality of what they're selling you. And that's why all of those companies are part of this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
In other international news, Swiss civil society has successfully submitted a popular initiative calling on the government to join the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and stand with the global majority in ending them. More than 100,000 Swiss people have spoken through this initiative. It triggers a national political process, and if the government refuses, the people will decide in a referendum. This is a big win for the campaigners of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. Over to Ukraine, where crucial repairs to a damaged power line near Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant were successfully completed under security guarantees agreed to by both Russia and Ukraine. This according to the International Atomic Energy Agency director, Rafael Mariano Grossi. Grossi said the repairs were carried out during a localized ceasefire arranged to ensure the safety of technical crews working in the area. It marked the third such instance in recent months where temporary truce agreements enabled the restoration of power infrastructure critical to nuclear safety. Without this power, cooling systems for the nuclear fuel that is in place would not be able to function, and with the overheating, could melt down and create a catastrophic accident. Also in Ukraine, it's a race against time at Chernobyl as the country moves to secure the crumbling radiation barrier. The protective structure, known as the New Safe Confinement, was installed to prevent radioactive particles from escaping into the atmosphere. Ukrainian officials say sections of the shield now require urgent maintenance to ensure its long-term integrity, especially as harsh weather condition and years of exposure take their toll. Interestingly, what is not mentioned in this article is that a Russian drone strike last February 2025 blew a hole in the roof and set a fire which compromised the integrity of the containment structure. As yet, no word as to whether the 1.5 billion euro or 1.75 billion US dollar structure is capable of being repaired, and if so, what the cost will be. But without that repair, Chernobyl once again becomes a radiological threat to the world. And we'll have more on this in the coming weeks, but the New START Treaty is expiring. On April 8th of 2010, U.S. President Barack Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev signed off on the New START Treaty, which served two key functions. It established an upper limit on the number of long-range nuclear weapons each nation could produce, up to 1,500 warheads and 700 long-range launchers, and set expectations for a mutual monitoring system. These are nuclear weapons of a size and scale that are meant to destroy centers of power across the world. At the time, the treaty was applauded for making headway on arms talks with Russia. Still, there was also plenty of criticism. John Erath, senior policy director for the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, said, "There was disappointment with START at first, but now a lot of people feel that it's very important and don't want to live without it. The problem is that soon enough, everyone will have to." In February of this year, 2026, the 2010 New START Treaty officially expires after being extended for 5 years in 2021. It cannot be extended again. As to the meaning and the import of the New START Treaty should it expire, we will have a link up to an article on this from the Outrider organization on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 759. Beyond that, I'm in the process of setting up an interview that will allow us to go over this information in depth. We'll be back with this week's featured interview in just a moment. But first, as we kick off 2026, Nuclear Hot Seat is in the process of going through a lot of changes, computer functionality permitting, which is a whole other story. We will let you know about these changes in the coming weeks as we roll them out. But right now, we are working with the intent of including transcripts on each week's episode, YouTube postings of each week's show to provide another platform for people to find us, expansion into additional social media platforms, and who knows, maybe a series of Nuclear 101 videos explaining the kinds of intro talking points and information that old-timers, like regular listeners to this show, take for granted, but that confuse the heck out of the newer generation of climate activists. I'm even learning a way to speed up the editing process for each week's show, which currently takes hours. It's exciting that I have found someone to coach me, who is both skilled in social media, backed by a team she can always get to, and staunchly anti-nuclear. Growth. It's a good thing. But it's also not an inexpensive thing. This will require some new software programs with monthly charges and some with annual fees. And in order to meet these new expenses on top of what it already costs to run the show, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and without them, the show cannot continue. So, in as nice a way as possible, I'm asking for your assistance as we move into an expanded 2026. That's why the time would be right now to support us with a donation of any size, be it a one-time or a monthly recurring donation of as little as $5. Think of it as the equivalent of buying Nuclear Hot Seat a cup of coffee every month, with a tip to the barista. Donations are the only way we can keep producing this show. So, help us out. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And with Zelle, no fees are taken out. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com and that red button to donate. And know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now, here's this week's featured interview. Linda Williams is a physicist, educator, and lifelong anti-nuclear activist who writes and performs songs as the Physics Chanteuse, a science entertainer. She battles against nuclear greenwashing, aka lying, with public presentations, lectures, theater, and a ferocious activist spirit, as well as serving on official panels and committees considering nuclear issues in her home state of Hawaii. Here, she discusses the latest developments in Hawaii's consideration of nuclear power. I spoke with Linda Williams on January 9, 2026. Linda Williams, it's always great to have you here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start out, first of all, just briefly about your past, your history, and what brings you to the nuclear issues.
Well, I'm a lifelong anti-nuclear activist. I'm a physicist, and I was a professor for 20 years. So I've been in this game a long, long time as an educator and also just doing outreach. My emphasis is not just education and outreach, but also music, theater, entertainment, trying to package this information in a way that's accessible. So I've been doing that for a long time.
You're based in Hawaii. What has the nuclear situation been in Hawaii?
Well, it's very interesting. Here in Hawaii, there, of course, is a nuclear military presence because of the nuclear-powered submarines and ships that are in Pearl Harbor. We don't have any nuclear weapons here anymore, but have in the past. And in terms of nuclear power, there's a constitutional amendment that forbids the building of any fission reactors or having nuclear waste in the state without a two-thirds vote approval in both state houses. So that has successfully prevented the development of nuclear power for all time. The island I live on, the island of Hawaii, is a nuclear-free zone that was recently approved by the county council. So that's great news and a, you know, example for the rest of the islands to hopefully take on. So because of that state bar from developing nuclear power, we've been nuclear power free in terms of civilian commercial nuclear power. This last year, however, a state legislation resolution was introduced to create a nuclear energy working group in the Hawaii State Energy Office to determine the quote-unquote feasibility of, quote, advanced, unquote, nuclear reactors. I was appointed by Hawaii 350 from 350.org to represent them on the working group, and I am happy to report that the final report from the Hawaii State Energy Office, which was just released last week, does not support developing nuclear power in Hawaii. It gives very strong arguments against why it's not a good idea, why it's not feasible. And primarily those reasons are the legal restrictions against developing fission power and also the fact that nuclear power is not part of the renewable portfolio that Hawaii needs to reach its goal of being 100% renewable by 2045. So it's a huge success because many states have been under attack to repeal these kind state laws prohibiting the development of nuclear power. And so for now, it's a win. They did say that they want to revisit in 3 to 5 years to see if the advanced reactor technology has advanced. And the other reason besides the legal barriers are that the technology doesn't exist. So since there's no commercially operating, quote, advanced SMR, small modular reactors operating anywhere in the world, you can't estimate the cost or the advantages or disadvantages. And that's the second main reason. They just said, we can't do an analysis for a technology that doesn't exist.
There's also the problem of radioactive waste. Are there specific provisions regarding that?
Yeah. In the Constitution, there's two parts. One is you cannot construct fission reactors and you cannot store radioactive waste. And that was, of course, another primary reason, saying that it's not feasible at this time. So it's good news, but I guess to appease some of the other people in the working group, they had to say, we'll revisit this in 5 years. The working group was about 12 people, most of whom were pro-nuclear. They had representatives from Nuclear Navy. They had representatives from the Nuclear Energy Institute, the DC lobby group, and myself and another representative from the university who's an expert in Fukushima radiation in the ocean was present. But I'm telling you, I wish I had a buzzer, because every single time one of the pro-nuke wankers would say something completely ridiculous, I would just raise my hand. I mean, I got exhausted after a while, but I worked tirelessly to provide that organization, the Hawaii State Energy Office, with everything they needed to do the right result. Because they even said, like, we're having a hard time finding peer-reviewed analysis of the technology. And I gave them everything they needed because they're not experts in nuclear technology. In fact, they did a survey of the group, and I was the only physicist. So I was the only physicist in this working group to determine whether or not it's feasible to develop nuclear power in an island state in the middle of the Pacific. It's absolutely absurd. Nor were there any Native Hawaiians invited to the working group, which I called out as well.
Yet another example of environmental racism.
Exactly. Because the beautiful thing, like why I live in Hawaii, is because the environmental philosophy or practice, I mean, it's central to the core of Native Hawaiians, is aloha aina. And aloha is breath. It is not just love, kissy kissy. It's like living in your higher state. And aina is the land. So aloha aina is to love the land. Also malama aina, which is to care for the land, restore the land. And in my estimation, those principles, indigenous principles of land stewardship, should be guiding all energy development. And unfortunately, it's not. And not even in a state like Hawaii.
What about other technologies that can address Hawaii's energy needs, not only now, but into the future?
We live in the middle of the ocean, and one untapped reservoir of power is the ocean itself, tidal power, ocean power. And then, of course, we have plenty of sunshine. There's geothermal, but that's complicated because fracking around an active volcano has potentially catastrophic geological consequences like lava eruption. But there's plenty of other energy options out here in the Pacific that are much safer and cheaper than nuclear power.
It sounds like in this working group, there were two of you who were in the oppositional position and 10 who were pro-nukers coming in. How in the world did you overcome that massive a voice on behalf of nukes?
Let me step back a minute. I would say there were also undecided. So there were several undecided, and then probably a third were pro, two of us vocally opposed, and then the rest were undecided. Here's what's beautiful. It's called the HSEO. That's the Hawaii State Energy Office. When this resolution was proposed, we organized and gave testimony against it, saying it was a waste of time because it's premature. And the HSEO office also submitted testimony that said it was premature to, you know, consider this technology. So I didn't have to convince them. So what I did for them was I supported them. I acknowledged that they had already said this. I worked with them. I said, I'll give you anything you need. Let me know how I can help you and I can support you with your already correct decision. So it didn't take that much because I think they were already maybe decided to begin with and already burdened and overtaxed with everything else they have to do. You know, so this was just a new responsibility that the legislature put on them. And unfortunately, primarily Democrats. Like, it was a bipartisan decision to create this working group. So, yeah, very disappointing. And a lot of so much ignorance because the spin for advanced nuclear and, the so-called Renaissance, I don't want to use the Renaissance. I want to say like World War II, not the Renaissance. The Renaissance was a beautiful thing. Anyway, it's so overwhelming. In fact, there was a representative who has been a long-time energy justice activist who's gone nuclear. And he was saying, and I'm not kidding you, that thorium reactors can come to Hawaii in a bus-sized box, be plugged in, and then unplugged and shipped off so that it wouldn't invoke the constitutional amendment because it's not being constructed and you wouldn't have to have waste. And I was just like, are you kidding? Like, not only does that not exist, it will never exist. So there's even the delusion, like if you call it a salt reactor or a thorium reactor, that fission isn't happening. I was just like on repeat, about trying to clarify these issues because there's so much hype, there's so much spin, there's so much disinformation, and it's really tragic.
What kind of weight does this report have? I mean, does it become government policy? Is it advisory? Is it the law? How is this going to play out as it goes forward?
This is advisory. So they just put it on the website, and I don't know if they mail it to all the legislators, but it's made available. And then I wrote an article which was published in our local Civil Beat. You can put that on your website, which has a link to it to get more attention because the office told me they weren't even going to do a press release. So I did it. Just to get the word out, because it's good news. And it's good news for activists in other states who are facing the same kind of attempt to overthrow their state laws. Because as the federal government weakens environmental protection and reviews and weakens the National Regulatory Commission, the NRC, state laws are going to matter the most. And that means that's true for nuclear power. And that's true for like data centers, like states stepping up and protecting themselves and their constituents matter. So we need to empower states to protect themselves against the federal government.
Are you in touch with any of the other groups that are working on state issues?
I don't know anyone in particular who's dealing with the attack on state protections. But that's an interesting thing. But I'm kind of moving on to other issues, like the Speed Act is primary for me because that is in the Senate right now. It passed the House in December, and the Speed Act will codify the gutting of environmental review through NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, permanently, and that needs to be stopped. So we'll talk about that another time because that could be catastrophic for the environment and the people who are working to protect it.
So, do you expect this to come around again in 3 to 5 years to still be a hot topic for pushing for nukes in Hawaii?
I do, unfortunately, because last year or the year before, this always comes up every year. And the time before it was fusion. We need a working group to pursue the feasibility of fusion power. And, my brain's just blowing up even thinking about that because fusion is the power of the future and it always will be, right? So, I mean, talk about premature. So, I don't know who is working with the nuclear lobby. Like somebody's coming in and giving them the legislation to propose. And so it just kind of goes through this cycle. With the fusion legislation, I lobbied hard with the folks who were proposing it and they ended up not introducing it. So, it's just there's 350 Hawaii is an amazing organization of activists who are watching legislation and seeing what comes up and informing everybody. So Sierra Club in Hawaii is fantastic watchdog because there's so much happening now, it's exhausting and you have to pay attention. So it seems to come up every year, some form of pro-nuclear something. So we just have to be paying attention and keep the watch and shoot it down before it can manifest.
Anything else you want to cover?
What it all comes down to is the weakening of the environmental review and protections, because that's the most critical thing. If we don't get proper legal environmental review. So the SPEED Act, I'm just going to, just in a nutshell, I'll tell you, because we got to do a story on it later. The SPEED Act will end injunctions. Oh, and no new science. So once the permit is given, you cannot sue with new science. And if you do sue and the court says, yes, we need to look into that, no injunction. So the project gets to continue. They're ending injunction. So it has to stop. The SPEED Act is terrifying. And who's heard of it? Nobody.
Linda, you've obviously done some very powerful activism in Hawaii on behalf of those of us who oppose nuclear and on behalf of the environment and the native people there and everyone who wants sanity when it comes to making certain that we have a future that is as nuke-free as possible. I want to thank you for once again being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Mahalo.
Mahalo to you. That was Hawaii-based physicist and activist Linda Williams.
Activist, shout out.
The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists will announce the new setting for the Doomsday Clock on Tuesday, January 27, 2026. It will take place during a live news conference at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 1500 Greenwich Mean Time. In 2025, the Doomsday Clock was set at 89 seconds to midnight, the closest to midnight ever in the clock's 78-year history. The decision is made every year in consultation with the Bulletin's Board of Sponsors, which includes 8 Nobel laureates. Here at Nuclear Hot Seat, while I hope for a frightening drop in the symbolic time between where we are and total nuclear annihilation, my prediction is that the Bulletin will chicken out and leave it where it's currently set. Find out for sure with the rest of us on January 27, when the ceremony will be streamed via the Bulletin's YouTube channel. We'll have a link up to it on this week's episode, Nuclear Hot Seat number 759. And on a sadder note, we mark the passing of John Barnard. For more than 10 years, episodes of Nuclear Hot Seat have begun with a jaunty jingle as its theme song. While I could hum it as a simple melody, the music was given life and energy through its performance by two musician friends, singer Marilee Weber and pianist John Barnard, who were also life partners. John's piano turned my simple ditty into a whimsical, bouncy tune that perfectly conveyed the other perspective of the show. The irony is that John was pro-nuclear, but like the good person he was, he never let politics get in the way of helping a friend. He later came around in his thinking while still maintaining a kind of energy skepticism. I'm saddened to report that John Barnard passed away last week after a long illness, leaving behind his partner Marilee, a legion of friends and music lovers, and a theme song. May his memory be a blessing every time you hear it. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, January 13, 2026. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. Help us out by getting on our database and going to nuclearhotseat.com. There will be a yellow box that pops up. Just put in your first name and email address so that every week you will get one email with the link to that week's show and a short description of its content. That way you need never miss a single episode. Now help us out with stories, because if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Yes, deeply appreciated. Any amount will help us out and will help the show keep going. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2026, Libby Halevi and Hartestree Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that, as Margaret Mead said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, It's the only thing that ever has. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So as you listen to John Barnard's whimsical piano playing, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.